Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 265, John Dunn's MI5 connection, King Ndlovu, and the relief of Ushowe. The last quarter of the 19th century was, in some ways, like the first quarter of the 21st century, full of tone-deaf business barons gambling, building vast riches, financing politicians, and in accelerating the planet towards world wars. There are ripples in the timeverse all the way to now, because the latest empire has started a war that it cannot end. The infinite rule of wars, do not start a war you can't finish. The British, back in 1879, had set off a whole host of pain for themselves by invading Zululand because the Boers of the Transvaal were flexing. First, however, was the small matter of trying to crush the Zulu Empire. Not only had the British suffered sharp reverses at Hlobane and most dramatically at Isandlwana, but Lieutenant Colonel Pearson's column had now been shut up in Ushowe for nearly 2 months. At first, the invasion had been greeted in Britain with confidence and patriotic support, yet that mood began to shift as the scale of the setbacks became clear and questions were asked about Lord Chelmsford's conduct of the campaign. Confidence gave way to unease as news filtered home that the war was proving far more difficult than anyone had expected. So it is to Ushowe we go. At the end of March 1879, Zulu warriors were spotted hiking down the hills near the Ushowe garrison, heading towards Inyezani near King Ndlovu on the coastal flats. They were led by Samopo of the Imangweni Ikanda, Cetshwayo's chief armourer, and the army he led towards the Tugela was an interesting bunch. They included 3,000 Tsonga from St. Lucia Bay, along with 1,500 from Kwa King Ndlovu Ikanda, joined by Dabulumanzi, Cetshwayo's headstrong son who lived at Ntumeni near Ushowe and who commanded 1,000 men. There were 3,000 men of the Ngumbamakosi, the Unkenke, the Umbunambi, and the Ngiyo, joined by 1,500 of the Ndluyengwe. Chief Sitkweli Kweli led these, along with Palani Ka Ndinwa of the Mpokunyoni. Palani was of royal blood and set an imposing figure amongst his troops. He wore brass ornaments on his ankles and his neck, and he had grown his fingernails 5 centimetres long. They were as white as ivory and gave him a dangerous cat-like appearance. He was tall, a kind of Marvel superhero of the Zulu. This force of 11,000 was in Lord Chelmsford's way, and he was about to cross the Tugela River to relieve Pearson in Ushowe. Cetshwayo was aware that the English Zulu chief had turned his coat. John Dunn, who had initially fled Zululand and tried to remain neutral, had now openly thrown in his lot with Chelmsford's relief column. He had observed the British response to the defeat at Isandlwana, and he knew that the Zulu could not win this war, nor even draw it. Chelmsford's response was to turn to Dunn, and with him came something the British had lacked until then, a practical understanding of African warfare. Dunn encouraged constant forward reconnaissance. He understood the rhythms and tactics of Zulu fighting and insisted on the discipline of lagering, measures that addressed many of the army's earlier weaknesses. He was placed in charge of 244 men and effectively made chief of intelligence, a somewhat unusual appointment. Until then, such responsibilities had normally fallen to regular British officers. Dunn, however, was no officer of the crown. What he brought instead were deep personal ties with the Zulu kingdom, along with a network of scouts and informants. In Chelmsford's camp, he would operate not only as an intelligence gatherer, but also as a crucial intermediary between the British command and the African world beyond their lines. Only a few years earlier, in 1873, the War Office had created its first permanent intelligence branch, signalling the gradual professionalisation of intelligence work. Over the following decades, that tentative institutionalisation expanded, eventually producing the Directorate of Military Intelligence, and, in the early 20th century, the creation of Britain's modern intelligence services. Dunn, therefore, sits at an intriguing midpoint in that long evolution. A frontier intelligence chief whose role foreshadowed the far more formal systems that would emerge in the age of modern espionage. Dunn's intelligence soon proved remarkably accurate. An Induna named Magumbi, who lived along the Mhlathuzi River near Ushowe, informed him that more than 10,000 Zulu warriors were waiting for the British once they crossed into Zululand. Magumbi even named the Amabutu and did so with notable precision. Yet he also reported an uncertainty among the Zulu leaders, which was also true. The Zulu had been called to fight, but the king's instructions remained unclear. They were not to hurl themselves against entrenched positions. The chiefs, however, were locked into their traditional mode of war. Unlike the Xhosa, who had learned to strike the army in guerrilla warfare fashion, hitting logistics and attacking when the columns were stretched out. This was going to be Cetshwayo's biggest mistake and a central failure of Zulu military tactics. After crossing the Tugela, Frederick Tesiger, 2nd Baron Chelmsford, took no chances. His four infantry battalions included the entire 57th, the 3rd, the 60th, the 91st, seven companies from the 3rd and 99th, a naval brigade detachment, two 9-pounder guns, four 24-pounder rocket tubes, two Gatling guns, a mounted contingent, and two battalions of the Natal Native Contingent. 3,390 white troops, 2,280 black. The largest army to ever invade Zululand up to that point. And he was going to need this firepower because the Zulu were not going to go quietly into the night. Chelmsford had also changed his mind after consulting Dunn. He was no longer going to march straight to Ushawi over the mountains, but take a parallel coastal route first, pretty much where the modern highway runs, rather than approach directly further west. At least he'd learnt a lesson from the San Luana, where the ammunition boxes had been left unopened and inaccessible to most of the British defenders. When they halted on the bank of the Nyoni River, Chelmsford ordered the boxes to be unscrewed and the lids taken out, and that the columns should use entrenching tools to cut a trench around the square-shaped laager. The four infantry battalions would take up a position outside the wagons, but behind the trench, and the NNC, the cattle, the horses, would be bivouacked inside the laager itself. On the 30th of March, the slow-moving column reached the Matakudu River, where Chelmsford halted to wait for the rest of his immense wagon train, lumbering lion nearly 10 kilometres long. During the delay, Dunn received fresh intelligence that the Zulu army was nearby and moving in their direction. It took most of the following day, the 31st of March, to bring the entire force across the river. That night, the British lagered scarcely a kilometre beyond the crossing. Mounted patrols rode out into the gathering dusk and began encountering parties of Zulu warriors moving through the countryside. Scouts, it seemed, watching the same ground from the other side. On the 1st of April, this lumbering behemoth of a column made a leisurely march to Gingindlovu stream, close to where Chief Godidi's Imizi was and where Pearson had fought an engagement weeks before on his way into Zululand. The British halted on a slight kopje, little more than a knoll, rising above the surrounding veld, from where the distant ridge of Ushawi lay some 25 kilometres away and in sight. Chelmsford ordered the familiar routine, wagons drawn into a laager, a shallow trench cut around the position, regular troops posted on the outer line, while the NNC, the cattle and horses crowded inside. But time pressed. The defences took hours to assemble, and in the haste, the long grass and thick bush surrounding the hill were left standing. Beyond 100 metres, the view dissolved into cover, a curtain of vegetation that concealed much of what was moving across the veld. The next 10 kilometres facing the British were swampland, very wet and difficult to traverse. The last 15, a steady ascent through very long grass and many undulations, making it ideal ground for a Zulu ambush that never happened. So it was with some relief that Chelmsford greeted Dunn's latest intelligence report. The Zulu were going to attack the column the next day, probably at dawn. The manner in which this information was gathered was also unique. Dunn had taken a small detachment and rode to the Inyezani River, swimming across at dusk and making his way north. Soon, he came across the huge Zulu bivouac on the hills between the column and Ushawi, and from his observations he realized they were preparing for battle. The Zulu did not fight in darkness. Their commanders relied on sight, on the lay of the land and the movement of men across it, to guide the great formation of chest and horns as it unfolded. From a distance, often from the crest of a nearby hill, the senior commander watched the battle take shape. Then he stood with his reserves, the loins of the army, sometimes as far as 5 kilometres from the fighting, studying the flow of the attack and waiting for the moment when those final warriors would be sent forward. The initiative now lay with Zulu Commander-in-Chief Somopo, advised by his lieutenants, including Dabulumanzi, Sicwelecwele, and Palani. 11,000 men awaiting their orders, with other senior chiefs like Masigwani and Imbulwani in attendance, although discredited after their last battle of Inyezani. Also providing his point of view was Isandlwana commander Mavumingwana. Later reports would surface that there was not complete agreement amongst these commanders, with Somopo originally planning an immediate attack on the British on the evening of the 1st of April, but de Bulemanzi apparently convinced him to wait till the next day. That was to allow the stragglers who joined the army to eat and rest before the exertion of battle. The British were up at 4 a.m., scouts were dispatched and rode out of camp. The horses were saddled, rifles loaded, everything was prepared, as is the case with most mornings at this time of year in Zululand, at least along the river valleys. A mist formed just before dawn, making the early morning gloom even more impenetrable. At 5:45, the scouts returned, reporting that a large number of Zulu were on their way. No orders had to be given. The defenders were ready. At exactly 6 a.m., Zulu came into sight, approaching from Inyezani and over Misi Hill, west of the laager. Ahead were the skirmishers, who opened fire on the British pickets, and they retreated behind the trench. A powerful Zulu column divided and crossed the Inyezani. The left division aimed at the right or northeast corner of the laager, and the second section, the chest, took aim at the central laager area, the north. The right horn, the weaker of the two wings, swung away from the main body and began working its way around the British left, aiming to strike from the west, while part of it pushed even further to outflank the laager from the south. The warriors moved at the double, spreading rapidly across the ground. Within minutes, the shape of the attack became clear, the familiar crescent tightening around the British position as the horns reached out to encircle the camp. Then they moved quickly towards the trenches, using the grass and bushes as cover. The defenders were amazed at how quickly they approached, the Zulu warriors firing as they moved. The Zulu left was about a kilometre from the British northeastern corner when the Gatling guns and the rocket launchers opened fire. Minutes later, the warriors were 300 metres away, and then the infantry fired a volley. The Zulu never managed to make it closer than 20 metres, and once again the British were stunned by their courage. Captain Hart wrote, "No whites ever did or ever could skirmish in the magnificent perfection of the Zulus, unencumbered by much clothing, in the prime of life, and as brave as it was possible for any men to be, they bounded towards us from all sides, gliding like snakes through the grass." At 6:40, the Zulu chest reached the northern face of the laager, but concentrated fire stopped them 100 metres away. They retreated, and Chelmsford ordered 120 mounted infantry and Natal volunteers to gallop out to keep them on the run. As with some other engagements, however, the Zulus stopped running and closed on the horsemen. The mounted infantry had to fight their way back to the laager. The Zulu right arrived at the British rear at 7 a.m., and despite the fact that they were a smaller section, it was this wing that was to cause the British the biggest problem. De Bulemanzi was leading the unit on his black horse as usual, urging his men on in the thick of the fight. He suffered a slight wound in his thigh for his trouble, but continued pressing on. The attack, like the others, stalled. Chelmsford ordered Major Barrow to gallop out from the eastern side with a large mounted force, 280 horsemen, and now the wavering Zulu fled. The Natal native contingent sprang into action behind the horsemen at 7:15, and retreat turned into a rout. One section of Barrow's men pursued the Zulu for 2 kilometres to Misi Hill, others headed south to the Matakulu River. A third group of British horsemen headed north, chasing the Zulu towards the Kwaginglovu Ikanda, then over the flooded Inyezani River from whence they'd come. In Ishowe, Pearson's men watched a long line of dispirited warriors trekking away north along the coastal country towards the Mlalazi River. They broke into smaller groups after reaching that river and disappeared. A few hundred turned at the Mhlathuzi River and walked up the valley to oppose a British advance. Chelmsford reported that 471 Zulu were buried around the laager, with another 200 found in a wider circumference around the battle site. All in all, about 1,200 warriors were killed. Many of the wounded speared or shot. Very few prisoners were taken. The British lost 2 officers and 11 men killed, and 48 officers and men wounded. A heliograph message could be seen from Ishowe congratulating Chelmsford, who flashed back that the garrison should prepare itself for departure the following day. The English were going to abandon Fort Ishowe. The road was too difficult for transport, and the centre of operations would shift to Gingindlovu. On the 3rd of April, Chelmsford left a garrison with the reduced laager and marched the 25 kilometres to rescue Pearson with 58 horse carts of provisions for the half-starved British in Ishowe. It was going to take them all day, the swamps, the grassy slopes, the ravines, thick bush, So it was with some surprise much later that the besieged British on the ramparts watched a solitary horseman appear at dusk. He was dressed rather oddly. An officer's coat, a sword, but who could it be? One of Pearson's staff, quoted by historian Saul David, wrote, "Who is he? A special messenger from Lord Chelmsford with important dispatches?" Afraid not. It was a man we last heard about a few episodes ago, a journalist by the name of Norris Newman, or Noggs Norris Newman, as he was named, of the Standard newspaper. He dismounted and shouted, "First in a corway," mispronouncing, with an air of self-satisfaction, as if he'd won some kind of race, which he had. A second rider appeared shortly afterwards, horse blowing and frothing. "Who is he?" we asked Newman, who replied, "That is the gentleman of the Argus newspaper." They both raced the other to be first in his shorway, a somewhat undignified way to end a siege, but at least they had their story. Chelmsford and his reduced column arrived at 6. Cheers rang out. The next morning, Pearson and his men began their long march back to the Lower Tugela, while Chelmsford led a mounted raiding party to Prince Dabulumanzi Zikanda at Intumeni Hill, about 12 kilometres west of Ishowe. They destroyed Dabulumanzi's home, but not before a surreal event played out on scenic Zululand grassy hills. When the English arrived, they spotted Dabulumanzi on a hill about a kilometre away with 40 of his men. Little puffs of smoke appeared, and lo and behold, the British were being fired on, the rounds striking rather close. John Dunn lay on his back, firing his rifle between his legs to allow for elevation, and for a few minutes, what is thought to have been Dabulumanzi and Dunn exchanged sniper fire, both missing the other. Dunn believed it had to have been Dabulumanzi because the fire from the hill was extremely accurate, and the Zulu chief was known to be a first-class rifle shot. Was it Dabulumanzi? Historians are not certain, but those on the hill that day believe no one else could have come so close to knocking off Chelmsford. On the 5th of April, the relieving column marched out of Ishowe, heading for Natal. Behind them, they left 6 officers and 35 men lying in a little cemetery. Soon after they had gone, the Zulus set fire to the buildings at the abandoned fort, but they left the graves and crosses untouched, a sign of respect for the dead. The next wave of large-scale attacks on Zululand were going to take place a month later in May. While all of this was going on, Lieutenant Colonel Evelyn Wood had managed to kill Imbilini, the hyena of the Pongola, as he was called, who'd been operating in northern Zululand. As a result, the British considered the Zulu of the northwest safely contained, and this was important because Chelmsford was hoping to concentrate his entire force on a final push to Undini. To come was the unfortunate matter of a French imperial who was going to face his Waterloo in the early winter African bush. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms and also sign up for my newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. You can email me from there too. Until next, Salagat.